No, I haven't either right here. Coming quick. Something?
Something more to drink?
Yeah, let's just try something like not so water, for example. You can use this one. Because the children can't sit in this class. At least the kirtan is there, huh? They can practice bhakti yoga really well. Well, let's see. Yeah, I got a little electrical machines here. Making a temporary permanent, huh? So ready to go? Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Samaniti Namane Namaste Sarasati Deve Gaura Varuka Charane Nivishesha Sunya Varuka Shatsa Desa Tarane Oma Gyanam Timaram Dasya Kanantara Salakaya Chaksun Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vansha Kalpa Dhruvya Shah Kreva Sindhu Deva Shah Patita Nam Padhevi Om Vaishnavi Om So, at the beginning of this Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna finds himself in a very difficult position. He's on a battlefield. It's a civil war. And in those days, civil wars are the nastiest kind of wars. Because it means those who are your enemies or those who you also love closely. Especially in this case, it's a civil war between basically cousins. Big battle, everybody there to fight. And Arjuna is looking over this battlefield and he's just horrified at the prospect, what's going to happen. And also, he's got a personal dilemma. What shall I do? I'm supposed to participate. That sounds wrong. If I don't participate, that's also wrong. What am I supposed to do? So he gives his reasons for not fighting and gives some philosophy about why he thinks it should be done. And Krishna smiles. That's what it says here. I'm looking at chapter 2, text 10. He smiled. I mean, here's this very grim situation. And Arjuna's in this terrible perplexity, and Krishna smiles. And then he says to him, while speaking learned words, because he's been quoting Vedic precepts and things like that and what the sages have said, he said, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise, he says, lament neither for the living nor for the dead. It's so heavy. And sounds really cold to us, maybe. And Krishna says this smiling to Arjuna. You are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Well, all these combatants on both sides, he's mourning for them. And he says, those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. That in either case, alive or dead, maybe you're lamenting for the living because they're going through so much difficulty, so many problems. No, don't need to lament for them, neither for those who have dead. So this is the beginning of his instruction. And here we should try to understand this. What is the problem of life? We are here, like Arjuna. We are here to solve a problem. Unfortunately, we're not even quite sure what the problem is. And most of our lives, we have substituted another problem for the real problem. Because we can't even face the real problem. And so, because we don't deal with the problem we're here to solve, we end up not really living our own lives and wasting our lives. So what is the problem? Well, let's look at our situation. We're here in this world. Now, that by itself, it's kind of a dumb thing to say, but if you start to think about it, it's really an extraordinary thing. We are here in this world. Now, what does it mean to be here? And when you start to think about it, it gets stranger and stranger and stranger. We remember back as far as we can, for example, and sometime, around the age of 2 or something like that, 2 years old, we sort of seem to slowly wake up. And we find ourselves in a body. Here I am. I'm suddenly I can say I, and I'm looking out of a pair of eyes on a world, and hearing through a pair of ears. And there's something really stunning. How did I get here? And we are in this particular body, and you know, it's a boy body or a girl body. And not only are we here, but we're in the middle of some kind of ongoing play or something. Like there's this whole drama going on. And suddenly, not only am I here, but I'm a person in this drama. I'm a player in this drama. Because here this is mother, and this is father. And this is maybe big brother, or little brother, or big sister. And this is my family, and these are those who are not my family. And this whole thing is going on, and here I am, just put in there. And I think I can remember being very puzzled about the whole thing. And of course, I didn't have any way of expressing to anybody how strange it was. Thank you. But if we look at it now, we can see it's really weird.
definitions of it.
Even to say, here, I am in this room, I'm in this body. I still can't understand exactly how this happened, but I'm in this body. I'm looking out of this pair of eyes, looking on the environment, and each of you are in another body, and you're looking out of another pair of eyes. How do we end up like this? What are we doing? What's going on? It's different. I mean, you can say, you know, this pair of cartels is in this room. It's here. But there's really different from this object and my body, because here's somebody's home. See, I'm undergoing experiences. These cartels are just an object, but I'm not just an object, I'm also a subject. So I have significance for myself. So this phenomena of being conscious is what the Bhagavad Gita really starts talking about in the beginning. That we are conscious entities in a material world. And the first thing Krishna says to us about this consciousness, that this is it turns out to be the symptom of a spiritual entity, the soul, the self. See, when I use this word, Atma, self, I can use it because I'm undergoing experiences. I can have this idea of the self. And it's because of consciousness and the self that inhabits this body. So here I am, I'm thrown into this world. I'm in this predicament. I'm undergoing these experiences. It's weird that I'm in this body. Why am I here in this family, not in the family across the street? How did that happen? How did I get here? What's going on? And we have a sense right away that we're supposed to be doing something. That there's something important is going on. That I'm here. I must be here, we think, for some reason. We have this feeling or this intuition. What is it? It seems like we have to accomplish something that's important, because we want our lives to have significance. Because we begin to understand more and more about this world, and we become more and more aware of the passage of time. And then we gradually come to realize that we're here, but we're not here for a long time. There's this thing called death that takes place, and we become introduced to it some way or another. When I was a little child, I think we had a pet cat. And the cat got hit by a car, smashed on the street. And then I noticed that when that cat was laying in the street, blood was coming out of it, just like it comes out of me when I cut myself. And so then I realized, uh-oh, this thing can happen to me. And you get very nervous. What happened to the cat? Well, the cat's dead. I have some authority, right? I think about it a while, and then I say, and I realize, you know, it's the same, you know, basically, some blood comes out and everything. Am I going to die too? Oh, well, but not for a long time. Don't worry about it. And then you get really insecure. You look at your parents. Wow, they're going to die too. Your parents are all powerful. They take care of you. You get nervous. You ask that question. And somehow or other, people tell you, don't ask this question. Don't worry about this. It's not an issue. But it is the issue. It's the really big issue. Because somehow or other this death is a problem to us. And why is it a problem? Well, we don't want to die. We want to go on living. And how long do we want to go on living? Well, yeah, how long can I have? Forever? So actually, we've got this desire to go on living. And and if this thing is going to happen where the body gets squashed and I'm suddenly gone, that just seems like really terrible. It makes my whole existence seem somehow meaningless, perplexing. Well, according to the Bhagavad Gita, this kind of intuition I think that everyone has, and as children, when you find out about things like death, and you wonder about what am I here for, and you wonder how I got here, those questions that people really say, this is not the issue. don't worry about it. Everything's going to be all right. You know. They put it off one way or another. These are the really important questions, because there's really an incompatible situation. Because according to this, the reason we want to live forever is because we are, in fact, eternal. The soul, where this consciousness is coming from, that is us. And consciousness goes on forever. It's never destroyed. But we're in this body, and what we have done is that when I say the word I mean the body I inhabit. Because right away we're given little designations. This thing happens to us, we're in the body. Before we can say anyway, there are people leaning over the group, aren't you cute? Look at your blue eyes. Look at your pretty hair, you know. You're so sweet. You know, so you, yeah, I'm the body, you know, and these people in the relationship to the body, they're somehow mine, and so on. So we have identified ourselves with this body, and therefore there's this incompatible. A situation for us. And what happens to us as we grow up and become educated, we become stupider. And actually, the culture we're in, that is to say a materialistic culture, is designed to make us stupid. Because it's almost a plot to hide the real questions. And to keep us in denial. So we get further and further deeper into this identification of the self with the material body. Because the other thing we want is we want to be happy. And that seems to be, want to go on living forever, and we want to be happy. And the only way we are taught that happiness comes from is by eating. That's a supreme source of happiness in the beginning. And satisfying our different desires and appetites. And we think this is where happiness comes from. But the trouble is, the more we enjoy these pleasures that arise from the senses, the more the identification with the body increases. And we're not usually taught nowadays to do these things in moderation, to do no more than necessary, or or to look anywhere else for our lives. This is your life. This is the meaning of your life. I tell you what the meaning of life in America is: to consume. Your duty as an American is to buy as much as possible, because it keeps the economy going. Even if you don't have money, you should buy, because you should borrow. Because that also keeps the economy going. So this is your civic duty. And everywhere, I don't know if it happens in this country, but people are, the designation is consumer. Like, you can subscribe to a magazine called Consumer Reports, you know, where they test the different things you buy to see which is better or worse. But you're a consumer. Your job is your job. Your duty is to consume. And that way, the more people produce, and then there's more jobs, and then they consume. So, you know, like this. Well, this is highly inadequate for us, because it just covers up the real problem. Because the problem is, we're conscious of time, and we're conscious of the fact that here I'm born at a certain time, or looks like to me like at a certain time I'm born and a certain time I die, and this consciousness is here for a while, and then it seems to go out. What am I supposed to be doing? Well, yeah, you have a few cheap thrills and you die. Is that it? Is that all? It's very difficult to live with that, because it just doesn't seem right. And then you look at your life, you somehow we want to have something permanent and eternal, and we want to have some significance. We want to accomplish something really worthwhile. And we try. But it's all substitutes for the real thing. Because what looks to happen, you know, you can see sometimes early in the morning, you can get up and the sun is just rising, and across the field the wind is blowing some fog or smoke, some mist being born across the field. And you look at it and you see, you know, here's this spoke. And it comes, and it's there for a little bit, and it goes away. But that looks like our lives. We're here, you know, that we're there a little while, and we're just blowing across the earth like smoke. We're here, and we dissolve, and then some more come, and they dissolve, and they more come, and they dissolve. You look back here on the land we are, you know, people, human beings have been here for so many centuries, and everyone, they're born and they struggle and they try to stay alive and they get in conflicts and they write books and they argue about significant things, and then they die and they disappear into the past, and after a while they're forgotten. Somebody else keeps coming and doing the same thing, and sometimes there's wars and sometimes there's peace, and people are, this is important and that is important, and it's all gone, it's over. What happened? What's going on here? Are we supposed to really accomplish it? If you look at things this way, it just looks like a whole panorama. It's a whole big scene of just meaninglessness. And everybody says, have another beer, forget about it. Turn on the television. Go back to sleep. Don't ask these questions. And we see that civilization is mostly a conspiracy, a substitution for a way of pretending that we've solved the problem. Is my life meaningless? Does it have no purpose?
No,
I have a purpose. I compete in the bowling league. You have bowling in this league? What was
soccer
league. Yeah, so I compete in some sport. I have a little sport thing. I get into the sport, and I go into competitions and school and things like that, and I win, and I get this gold thing. You have those. And I put them on my wall, you know. And I get a whole list, these gold, with guys on the top going like this, you know. And then I sit and I look and say, see what I've done? My I'm important. So people everywhere, they have rooms full of these things. They say, I'm important. I know that in the capital of America in the United States, you know, the government people and generals and people like that, they all have in their offices something that's usually called the wall of respect. You go into their office, or sometimes they have it in their houses, they have one wall. And on it are, if they're army people, they have their letters of commendation and their medals hanging up. And then if they're politicians, they're shaking hands with the president or shaking hands with this person. And they have all these things, and their awards, their commendations. You got to get some degree, you put that up. So this is called the wall of respect. So, you know, somebody comes and they sit waiting to talk to you, and they look at this, oh, an important person. But the main person is for you. You can sit right down and say, look, see what I've done? I'm important. So many people know my name. They also cut out the newspaper articles in which their names have appeared, and they keep that. What happens to those newspapers? keep on going, you know, you're important now, 10 years passes, 20 years, 30 years, and then after a while, you know. No, so some name remains in history, Napoleon Bonaparte. He has something to torture schoolboys with for a little while. They have to learn and then forget, you know, that's all. But if you do happen to see, you know, how these people live, so much effort, so much work, so much suffering, so much striving. What's there to show for it? What's there to show for it? So we substitute these different things. I will become a general. I will win wars. I will get a medal. I will get some recognition. Somehow or other, I'm important. But it's like a false religion. It doesn't really solve the death problem. It's a way of covering it up, so we can lie to ourselves like this. So it really is worthwhile, actually, first of all, to deal with the real problem. To deal with this. The real problems in life is the death problem. A few other things associated with it, but really that. We want to have lives that are worth something, that have achieved something that's permanent. Because to do anything well in this world, you have to work hard. I don't care what it is. If you have some profession or anything like that, if you want to be good, you have to work really hard. But what you achieve is something temporary. Prabhupada describes it, what you achieve, as a little mental satisfaction. Oh, I wrote a good book. Or, I have a nice house. I have a nice family. It's like you could say something to yourself like that. But your book will be forgotten, your family will all disappear, you'll all go away. You know. But it's so hard to do anything well. So what we need to do is to be able to put our effort into something that gives a real result. That is to say, something that isn't wiped away by time. When we become entangled, what happens to us is as we try to become enjoyers in this world, we identify more and more with the material body, and whatever we achieve by our efforts is simply a temporary thing because it's on the material platform. That our happiness now depends upon the course of events that are largely beyond our control. And ultimately, in all, we are engaged what is called the struggle for survival. Of course, this is a famous term, the struggle for survival, describing life in the material world. And the Bhagavatam also talks about this struggle for survival. Because every living entity at least wants to stay alive. Let's don't even talk about human beings. Let's talk about a little microbe. Whatever it is, it wants to stay alive. We have learned this in our biology class. What do they call it? The instinct for self-preservation. It just wants to be alive. And so do we. Because actually those microbes, they're subjects too. They have their significance for themselves. They're not dead. And anything that's alive wants to stay alive. We can see that. So we are also carrying on this struggle for survival. So what this means is that we have declared war on material nature. Prabhupada describes it like that. We have declared war on material nature because what we think it means to be alive is to keep the body alive, to survive the assaults of the environment, to protect ourselves against death. That's what we think it means. So we have, when people get money, they want to protect themselves. They have security systems with electronics. I read a description of Bill Gates' house. You know how secure it is? with the electronic devices and the hidden cameras and this motion sensors and everything like that. He's protecting himself, right? He wants security. But you know, with all those defenses and all those guards and all those cameras and all those barriers, death will come through. They will and dispatch him. You'll go. So we have declared war on material nature, and it is a battle we are sure to lose. Because material nature has declared that every body, everything made of material nature that's been put together, has been assembled, will be disassembled. We will die. But Prabhupada calls this struggle for existence a mistake. It's an illusory struggle for existence. Because it's absolutely unnecessary. And that's why he says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Na jayate mrigate va kadachin." For the soul, there is neither birth nor death at any time. For the soul, nayam bhutva bhavita va nabuyaha. For the soul, there's no going and coming into being or going out of being. Bhutva, not in the past, Bhavita, not in the present, Puyaha, and not in the future. The soul is Ajaha, unborn, Nityaha, eternal, Shastataha, permanent, and Purana, very old. Nahanyate hanyamani sarire, he is not slain when the body is slain. If that's really the case, there's no need to struggle. The struggle is all due to this thinking that our life depends upon the preservation of this body. But it doesn't. So this is an illusory struggle for existence. Once we come in the material world and identify with the body, then we're engaged in a war we're going to lose. It is always good advice from a political or military point of view. Never get in a fight you're going to lose. You should not do that. So the solution to this problem is what's being offered in the Bhagavad Gita. First of all, we should recognize the real problem, and that's why Krishna smiles, really, because although Arjuna is in the middle of what looks like a really bad problem, there's no problem. Krishna can see, he's not confused, and Arjuna is confused. So Krishna sees the soul, he sees what is happening, and he actually sees the problem is illusory. It's true that Arjuna is suffering. But the suffering itself is like the suffering of a person who's lying asleep and having a nightmare. Now, in the nightmare, he's created a dream body and is identified with the dream body. And so in the dream, he's undergoing some suffering. He's being chased by a tiger in the jungle and is terrified and is... But if you're in the room, you're watching this person asleep. You know he's safe. There's no danger. Everything is all right. Now, out of compassion, what do you want to do? Wake him up. But everything is fine. There's no problem. You just wake him up. And that's what Krishna is doing. He's just going to wake him up. See, if you really see the reality, wake up out of this dream, you'll see there really is no problem. Now, the waking up process. We have to cooperate a little bit in this. Krishna doesn't everything. To use another example that Prabhupada mentions, when Krishna saves us, it is like he's giving us a rope to get out. Like if somebody falls in a well, you're down in a well, you're crying for help. So somebody comes to save you. What do? They throw down a rope. There's one thing you have to do. You have to hold on to the rope. That much you have to do. So we have to participate. It's actually Krishna who pulls us up and Krishna who gets us out of this predicament. But we have to hold on. That's all. And then we'll be freed. So in the Bhagavad Gita, in the first chapter, there's two things that are described. One is just a kind of understanding what is the difference between who I am, the self, and this body, which is the not-self. And it is described how the self is eternal, the body is temporary. We've projected our idea of ourself onto the body, and this is a false thing. So the first instruction, of course, that we get in spiritual life, in transcendental life, in the, from the Vedas, is Aham Brahmasmi, I am spirit, which also means I'm not matter, which then means I'm not the body. And once there's a new devotee tried to explain this to a person while I was out on the street distributing Back to Godhead magazines, that you're not the body. And he said, what kind of philosophy is this? He says, you're trying to say I'm not me. So that identification with the body is very deep. I'm not me. Because we become embedded in this. And just, I can say I'm a believing Hare Krishna devotee, and I believe that I'm a spirit soul and I'm not the body. But just believing that, theoretically, actually by itself does not destroy my identification with the body. When something goes wrong or there's some problem, I get hurt, my body gets hurt, it's happening to me. I'm distressed. I'm upset. I feel threatened with death. And so on. These things. This identification is still there. But that's why there's something else that needs to be done. And so the other side of the coin is what Krishna calls Buddhi Yoga in the first chapter. First there's Sankhya Yoga, understanding the difference between matter and spirit, and then acting in the world in such a way that this identification of the self with the material body will go away. And what he says is that we have to act in the world because we do have the body and the senses, and anyway, it's the soul itself which is by nature active. But we have to act in such a way that we do not increase our identification with the material body. And that means the actions we perform should be not for our own satisfaction. Krishna says, you have a right to your actions, to your activities. We all do different things with our bodies are like, and including our minds, are like kind of set up that we're good at some things and not good at other things. And you know, some of us can have babies and some of us can't, and some we all have our different things that we can do, and we have a right to do that. He said, but you do not have a right. What doesn't belong to us is the fruit of the action. See, whenever we do an action, it's because we want some result. There's a motive, and there's a desire. And we become attached to the fruits of the action. And that's called karma. Those actions are then called karma. They produce deeper identification with the material body, and ultimately repeated birth and death in the material world. So to break, to act is okay, that's all right. But the problem is that we act with the idea of enjoying the fruits. Well, if I'm not desiring anything for myself, why should I act at all? And the answer is that actually we should act so that who's satisfied, it's not my satisfaction I'm concerned with, but the satisfaction of Krishna. There has to be some desire for there to be an act, but our desire has to be not for ourselves, but for Krishna. Then we can act in so many ways and we do not become entangled. And by acting in that way, gradually, the identification of the self with the material body goes away. And actually, just by acting to serve Krishna, this becomes an automatic byproduct. But the problem is with bodily identification and with enjoying in the material body unnecessarily is that it causes suffering. In the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a really startling sentence by Krishna. He says, "Yehi samsparasaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate." What this says is those samsparasaja bhoga. Most devotees know this word bhoga. It means pleasure or enjoyment. So those enjoyments, or those pleasures, samsparasaja, which arise from the contact, the sparsha, between the senses and the objects. That's what he's talking about. We bring our senses into contact with the appropriate objects, and then there's some feeling of pleasure. Right? And Krishna says, these pleasures are in fact the source of all suffering. Dukkha is the word for suffering. Dukkha yonaya evate. So what he's saying is that what we think is happiness, or the cause of happiness, is actually the cause of just the opposite. This is the and why is this? Because all suffering comes because we identify ourselves with the material body. We experience whatever happens to the body as happening to me. So certain things will happen to the body, no matter what. The body will grow old. This is not pleasant. When you're really young, you know, the body's quite delightful and a lot of fun to be in. Gradually, it becomes more and more difficult. The body will grow old. The body will become diseased. And this is happening. You notice after so many years of medical progress, there's still disease. In fact, new ones keep cropping up. Really what happens is one set of diseases gets replaced by another. And if those get taken care of, then another group comes in. So disease is going to be there. And the body will die. While we're in the body, it falls apart around us. And we're thinking, you know, look, my God, look what's happening to me. You know, here is this face which was young and good looking, and now I look in the mirror and here's this horrible wrinkled mask. Can that be me? What happened? Yeah, you can cover it up with makeup and go to the surgeons and all these other things, but still, basically, the process will continue. You know, you may end up looking like Michael Jackson here. It just doesn't work. So the body falls apart while you're still in it, and then you think this is happening to me, and then the body dies, and you think now I'm being annihilated. This is suffering. And this suffering comes about because of this identification of the self with the material body. And that identification comes about, this false ego is formed by every act of enjoyment. When we try to enjoy the senses, it causes us to identify deeper and deeper with the material body. So a civilization which looks to sense gratification as the only meaning of life is actually causing great harm to everybody and increasing the suffering. And you may have noticed that although there's been material advancement of civilization, it does not seem that people's suffering is going away. If they don't have some physical suffering, it's been replaced by mental suffering. Why are so many people suffering from depression? What have they got to be depressed about? Like in America, that's the biggest problem. Children, you know, all these children on antidepressant drugs. You know, they've got all facility for happiness and they're depressed. Well, in some ways, if you have all these things, then you still wonder, what am I doing here? What's my life for? What's its purpose? And everybody says, you got it. Oh, this is it? Well, naturally, you're depressed. Because you have to understand something. If people are depressed, it is mostly because everything is, in fact, depressing. So it's not a mental illness, it's sanity. It's just realism. If I think that everything I've got is here in this body and this is it, it's only reasonable to be depressed. If you don't anything know about who you are and what you're supposed to be doing with your life and what it's for, yeah, you should be depressed. So how are they? What are they going to do if everybody is depressed? Oh, well, you know, give you some pill. That's all simple problem. You just put everybody on drugs, which is another way of just covering up the problem. And I'll guarantee you that these drugs will create more problems than they solve. We have already seen this enough times. But this is not the solution. So people need to understand these things. It's very, very important. So really, in a very scientific way, this has been described in the Bhagavad Gita. Most traditional religions at least teach some of this, but people have gone away from those because people no longer understand the science don't understand that there's a spiritual science. They think it's some religion, it's some faith. Because in many cases, some of the ideas still survive, but not the process, not the application of these ideas in a practical way. And so you find this all together, the complete spiritual science. This is what Prabhupada brought. The introduction to it is in the Bhagavad Gita. Everything is there. And as time goes on, people always need it, but they're more and more, they'll become desperate. Prabhupada mentions that in talking about this, there's the story about King Paranjana, an allegorical story, who went out to hunt. And this hunting in the forest of material enjoyment means this overindulgence in materialistic life. And he becomes fatigued. And in commenting on this, Prabhupada remarks, he said the whole material civilization is on the brink of becoming tired, exhausted of its material activities. On the verge, he said, it's about ready to happen. And this is quite true. So people need to know what is the alternative. What is really the why we are here, what we're supposed to be doing, so that we can, although it's true we're in this particular body in this life for a short time, still we can use it to great and eternal value. We can make something of our lives that's really worthwhile. So that our spiritual development, even if it's not complete in one life, it will not be lost. We will continue, and we can actually do things for other people that will really help them. not get them further entangled in misery. Well, that's what Prabhupada gave the instructions to his disciples. Said you should become Krishna conscious yourself, and then he said you should have some feeling for suffering humanity. People are suffering, and if you trace down the ultimate cause of their suffering, it's from this lack of Krishna consciousness. So we should do something in this way to help others. Well, we have to become Krishna conscious ourselves, otherwise we can't give it to others. We have all facility to do this. So we should take advantage of this. When some kid is born and he says, "What am I doing here? What's the meaning of life?" We can tell him, "This will be welcome to the human form of life. This is how you got here. This is your business. This is what you're supposed to be doing. Yeah, your body will go. That's a fact. But meanwhile, here's what's supposed to happen. You should understand. I'm a spirit soul, and I'm in the body. I'm your father, but all of us are eternal." And so, give them the news. What's really going on and what they're supposed to be doing. Some real achievement will be there. Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna. Any questions, comments, discussions? Yeah.
Nochmal auf diese Situation von Arjuna und Krishna, wo der zwischen diesen zwei Fronten stand. Ich kann das nicht auf Englisch, wenn ich vielleicht kann näher übersetzen. Wo der zwischen den Fronten stand. Da erinnere ich mich an eine ähnliche Situation, die auch gar nicht so lange her, mit Mahatma Gandhi.
Arjuna is standing between the two frontiers, and that reminds me of a similar situation about Mahatma Gandhi.
Und der hat ja dann letztendlich, ich weiß ja nicht, in welcher Form hat der denn gekämpft, der hat sich ja letztendlich auch nicht gewehrt.
In which sense did he fight? I mean, he was not defending himself from...
Who?
Wer?
Gandhi?
Gandhi. Also mal so darauf bezogen, wo die Engländer und gegen Indien.
Ja. Yeah. Yeah.
Der hat ja letztendlich, war ja sein Weg, einfach nichts zu machen quasi. Und dadurch ist er weltberühmt geworden, sagen wir mal so.
Also, his path was sort of to not do anything and he became world famous for it.
Well, that was a very good strategy under the circumstances. If he actually took arms against the British, he would have lost. But his strategy worked because there was the media to watch him. If he just stood there and did his satyagraha with no media, they would have just run over him. So actually, it was a very, very clever strategy. How he using the attention of the media and the sympathy of the people, he could actually gain the upper hand.
Yeah.
But Arjuna is a different situation. Arjuna is a warrior. And so the duty of a warrior is sometimes to become violent on behalf of religious principles. That's a necessary part of society. Every society needs to be protected. Kshatriya means one who protects. They protect the society internally from criminals and things like that, and externally against sometimes foreign aggression. These are both functions there. And I don't think you want the police to be pacifists. You don't want the police to be pacifists. When some criminals are coming with guns and everything, you don't want them to, you know, lie down in front of them.
Ja, dann noch mal eine Frage. Irgendwie habt ihr vorhin was gesagt von, wir haben der materiellen Welt den Krieg erklärt. Aber Buddha hat irgendwie gesagt, man muss die Mitte finden zwischen der materiellen Welt und zwischen der spirituellen Welt. Ist es, man kann doch meiner Meinung nach nicht eins irgendwie weglassen und in das andere nur hochheben. Das ist doch.
You said something of that we declare war on the material world. And then Buddha said that one has to find the middle between the material world and the spiritual world. One can, and I think one cannot just leave out one side completely. And just
no, he's right about that. What it means is. That the meaning of the path of bhakti yoga is that we use our senses and we use the material object. We don't turn away from the material objects, neither do we turn away the senses, but we use them in such a way that they will not cause entanglement. And this is the idea of non-attached action. So this is there. Some people want to do like that. They want to go completely away from the world and try to shut the senses down. And that's wrong. Like, for example, this is true about Buddha. At one time he tried to fast. You've seen some pictures of him, very, very skinny and very thin, you know, complete super austerity and fasting. Because it's a fact that every time you take a bite of food and chew on it, every bite gets us deeper entangled in material nature. So there are people in a religious vocation who try to stop eating. In Europe, in the Middle Ages and earlier, there were saints who tried to live on nothing but, you know, a little communion wafer. You know what the you know how in Mass, this is my body, behold the Lamb of God, you know, this is like a little piece of chapati. That all they would eat, nothing else. So they only wanted to eat spiritual food. So Krishna says, if you offer me nice, you cook for me and you offer it to me, I'll accept it if you do it with love and devotion. And then we can eat the remnants, but it's not just one little piece of bread, it's a feast. So you cook and you eat, but you do it in such a way that actually every bite gets you closer to God. And you have karmaless food. So that's the middle way. That's the middle way. We practice that also. Buddha stole it actually from the Vedas. We put it in a different way, but that's where it comes from.
Yeah, and the love also.
Huh?
And the love as well. Und die Liebe.
Yeah, sure. Anything else?
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Yeah. Just one question. There's always one thing that is very confusing me, and it's a thing Krishna says, who thinks that he's a doer. He's not right, because actually the material energy, the three modes of materiality, they are doing, so they're providing all the activities. So I'm thinking actually I'm the doer, so I have, sometimes I'm thinking about my self-realization, so what am I actually, what is a self? So, but it's so mixed with all the doings, with all the activities, so I cannot figure out which is actually just the material covering, which is just the false ego, mind, and so on, or the wishes, and so on. And what types of it, of the wishes, of the personality, what characteristics of
if you look at it, like this, let's just take a simple action. I lift my hand. I get the idea I want to lift my hand, and then I lift my hand. Okay, how did I do that? I have no idea. All I know is somehow I'm in this machine, and that if I want to lift my hand, it does it. And the actual fact is that the soul really has no connection with the material energy. What I do is I have a desire to lift my hand, and then Krishna lifts it. He, as the super soul, he's sitting in the heart, and he's the one that controls the material energy. And so the material energy works with reference to my body and my desires, because Krishna's doing everything. So part of being Krishna conscious is that I should not see myself by myself. That there's me and there's Krishna. We're together. Right? Like these two birds in the tree, the bodies of you, we're together. And actually, I cannot do anything. It's Krishna that does it. And as I act more and more just to serve Krishna's desire, I see how Krishna is more and more taking control. So the Prabhupada ultimately says that when one becomes a pure devotee, Krishna takes complete charge of the senses of the devotee. Senses meaning not only the Gyanendriya, the knowledge acquiring senses, but also the active senses like the hands and the legs. So that Krishna is actually controls the senses of the devotee for him. So that way we can think of Krishna always and be aware of Krishna, and then he operates everything for us. No problem for him. that's what happens. But otherwise the material energy is working under Krishna's direction and not ours. Mayabjakshina prakriti, you know, it is really, I mean, Krishna's working through the whole system of material nature, and that material nature is working, but the material nature is, Krishna said, it's under my superintendence. But I say, kartaham, you know, I am the doer. But I'm not. It's Krishna who's doing it. Is that okay? Okay. Clear? Yeah.
While you were answering a question arrived in my head, so you said that the super soul is directing according to our wishes, the material modes. But on the other hand, Krishna says that he has no interest in this world, and that in some way also he is far away from that. So how can we understand or how can we meditate right about Krishna? Think right about Krishna?
You think of Krishna as doing what sounds like contradictory things at the same time. You read in the Ishapanishad, he's very near and he's far away as well. He's inside everything and he's outside of everything. Okay. You just say those things over and over again. Yeah, Krishna is quite on a very, 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 very different level from us. Otherwise, we can't understand him. It's just like if in this room there's some ant crawling. Can you explain to this ant about human society, about the city of Weimar, about the Bundesrepublik? I mean, you can't, you're right, the ant is not capable of. The distance between the ant and ourselves is far less the difference, the distance between us and Krishna. But somehow or other, what Krishna can do for us is that he can still communicate to us. To some, yeah, and he can, as he says, Dadami Buddha, I give them the understanding by which they can come to me. We can't do this for the ant ourselves, you know. We don't have that power. But Krishna has the power that even given our limited nature, he can give us enough understanding so that at least we can come to him. As far as understanding him, forget it. We're just, you know, we can't understand even material nature. As soon as people try to really understand, they become all confused. And they get theories that look contradictory. What is light? Is it a wave? Is it a particle? Is it a wavicle? No one knows what they're talking about. That's just a simple thing, you know? What about the big things? Well, we just have to be humble. And our goal is ultimately, to some extent, we can understand Krishna. He's explained himself, and we can also have realized knowledge about Krishna. But even Krishna doesn't understand himself, actually. He's always amazed. So, yeah, but our idea is ultimately to love Krishna. That enter into relationship with him. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.